This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
17 days. That's the window. On Valentine's Day of 2022, Corey Richens gave her husband a sandwich laced with fentanyl. Eric Richens got violently sick. He called two friends, told them he felt like he was going to die. His body erupted. He could barely breathe. And then he survived. 17 days later, she did it again. This time with five times the lethal dose mixed into a Moscow mule she made to celebrate her real estate closing that he thought was an utter disaster. Because it was. Because all of the decisions Corey Richens made professionally, and it looks like personally, have been exactly that. Utter disasters. She is a woman with a broken brain, in my opinion, in the opinion of the court, in most people's opinions. Eric did not survive that second attempt. Everyone who follows the case fixates on the how, the fentanyl, the drink, the 911 call at 3 a.m. But if you want to understand Corey Richens, not the crime, but the person, the question that matters is what happened in those 17 days. Because whatever internal framework allowed her to attempt this on Valentine's Day didn't collapse when it failed. It recalibrated. She didn't stop. She adjusted. She got more. She tried harder. And understanding that recalibration is the key to understanding everything she did before, during, and after. This is the first of our five-part series about Corey Richens' broken brain. Press subscribe so you don't miss this as we drop a new one for you every single day here on the podcast feed. If you've been relating to the Corey Richens story, like I have, this is another series that will help you really kind of grasp the framework of this type of thinking of a person like Corey Richens, because there's a lot of Corey Richens out there. They don't all necessarily get this far in the land of chaos and murder. But so many, and the majority of this type of thinkers, produce such chaos as their lives are human tornadoes that go through unsuspecting souls with no regret and no self-reflection. This series should hopefully help you recognize that a little bit easier and sooner. Because quite honestly, people easily fall victim to someone like a Corey Richens. I did. A lot of people have. Male, female, doesn't really matter. They're out there. Recognizing it and also being able to see a path out of it is so incredibly important. So, as we go through this, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube, we'd love for you to weigh in. So let's talk about the architecture, not the physical evidence. The jury handled that, the psychological architecture, the internal operating system that had to exist for a suburban mother, a real estate agent, a woman who would go on to write a children's book about grief, a ghostwrite, to arrive at the decision to acquire a street drug she described as the Michael Jackson stuff, and then put it in her husband's food twice. I want to be clear about what this series is and what this isn't. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not diagnosing Corey Richens with anything. What I am is someone who spent years inside this case. And the more time I've spent here, the more I needed to make sense of the decision-making. Not just what she did, but how her brain got there. How it justified each step. How it kept functioning through things that would shut most people down. These are my observations connecting dots based on what has come out of trial, what's in the public record, and what the behavioral patterns tell us when you lay them out together. This is about trying to understand how a broken decision-making process works and why. That's a nice way of putting it, isn't it? You're just a broken decision-making process. Just tell yourself that over and over, Corey, it might help you sleep at night. Although I don't think she really has any problem because she believes her bullshit enough. This didn't start on Valentine's Day. The psychological groundwork was laid over years. And it started, as it almost always does in cases like this, with the gap between who Corey Richens believed she was entitled to be and who she actually was. Josh Grossman, Corey's boyfriend, testified that she told him she grew up scrubbing toilets for wealthy people in Park City and promised herself she would own those homes one day. It's not just ambition. That's an identity contract, a deal she made with herself about who she was going to become. And look, there's nothing wrong with, I'm going to rise out of this someday and do better. And people do this all the time. That's fine. That's good. I think that's a healthy thing to do. When you can actually do it without destroying yourself and others along the way. By 2021, she was running a real estate business, flipping properties, living in an upscale community outside Park City on the dime of her husband. And she was $4.5 million in debt herself. One wouldn't necessarily say, when you look at the numbers, that she's necessarily stepped out of where she came from. In fact, you'd almost argue she's worse off than where she was initially, having $4.5 million in debt. The forensic accountant at trial testified that her business was, in their words, imploding. But her friends saw something different. They saw success, confidence, a woman who appeared to have it all together because that's how she performed. That gap between the projected image and the financial reality is where the psychology starts. Because for someone with certain personality structures, shall we call them, that gap doesn't produce a moment of reckoning. It doesn't produce humility or a decision to scale back. It produces desperation to close the gap by any means necessary. The false self, the version she'd built for the world, could not survive exposure, and everything that followed was an attempt to protect that version of herself from collapsing. Think of it as a house with rooms. In one room, Corey's a successful businesswoman building an empire. In another, she's a devoted mother raising three boys. In another, she's drowning in debt that would destroy everything if anyone found out or opened the door. Each room is sealed from the others. Each one functions independently. And the person standing in the success room doesn't hear the panic coming from the debt room. They don't talk to each other. The walls are the whole point. Eric was becoming a problem. Not because he was a bad husband. By all accounts, he was a devoted father, an outdoorsman, a man who built a successful masonry business with his own hands. The problem was structural. By 2020, the marriage was functionally two people occupying the same house for different reasons. Eric consulted a divorce attorney. He created a living trust that routed his entire estate to his sister Katie for the benefit of his three sons. He transferred his business partnership into that trust. He was building a wall around his assets because, as testimony would later suggest, he didn't trust his wife with them. I mean, think about that. I get protecting your assets, without a doubt. I understand that. But when you have to literally do this while you're active in this marriage and you're hoping maybe things get better, but you're sleeping with the person next to you at night that you have to put this many walls around you with, that's not a good place to be, ever. I'm not faulting Eric. I get it. I've been there. I guess all I could say is to those who've not been there yet, try to learn vicariously through the mistakes of others. The mistake of staying with someone like that for as long as he did, it cost him his life. Many others get out, it doesn't cost lives, it comes close. It costs mental stability, well-being, trust, safety, things that one time you may take for granted in other people, and it makes you thoroughly question every single person who comes along your path. Not to say that you can't get there. You can. And maybe the caution is part of the tale, part of the story, part of life. Maybe it's something we should all have a little bit more of going into anything we do. But there's caution and there's trauma. And Corey was a trauma-creating machine. Here's a detail a psychotherapist would likely flag. Eric's decision to create that trust wasn't just financial planning. In Corey's psychology, it was a declaration that she didn't deserve what she believed she was owed. The man she married had looked at their relationship and decided to protect his assets from her. For most people, that would be a wake-up call. For somebody whose identity depends on the belief that she deserves a certain life, it reads as theft. Eric wasn't protecting his children. He was taking what was hers. And that reframing from he's being careful to he's stealing from me is another brick in the Corey's broken brain justification wall of shit. Meanwhile, Corey was texting Josh Grossman. If he could just go away and you could just be here, life would be so perfect. That was February 22, 2 weeks before Eric's death. She asked Grossman if he'd marry her, if she was divorced, and he said yes. But divorce wouldn't solve her problem. The prenuptial agreement she signed in 2013 meant that if they split, Eric's major assets stayed with him. His business, his properties, the things that represented the life she'd told herself she deserved. But if Eric died while they were married, the calculus changed completely. She had a claim on the estate, the insurance policies she'd taken out, approximately $2.2 million worth, including one she applied for fraudulently with a forged signature, would pay out. The boyfriend was waiting. The debts maybe could somewhat be covered. The image could be maintained, even though the math doesn't add up in any way, shape, or form. But in Corey's mind, maybe it could. Maybe. When you have that level of delusional thinking, anything's possible, right? That's the moment the spouse stops being a person and becomes a variable. Eric wasn't a man she was planning to leave. He was an obstacle between Corey and the life she believed she was owed. And once a human being gets reduced to an obstacle in someone's internal math, the moral guardrails that prevent most people from ever crossing certain lines simply just don't apply the same way anymore. He's not a father tucking his boys in at night. He's the reason the numbers don't work. The affair with Grossman functioned as an accelerant. Every text about their future together was a micro permission. Every conversation about houses they'd buy and lives they'd build was another brick in an alternative reality where Eric was already gone. She wasn't just cheating. She was rehearsing her next life. And the more real that future became in her mind, the more disposable the present became. And then came January 2022. Prosecutors presented evidence that Corey logged into Eric's life insurance policy and changed the beneficiary from his business partner to herself. The insurance company caught it and notified Eric, and it was changed back. She was caught committing what would later be charged as fraud. And she didn't stop. That's a tell. A person operating a normal risk assessment, recalibrates when you've been caught. They pull back. They get scared. They wonder if they're being watched. Someone with this psychological profile recalibrates the method, not the goal. The goal is fixed. It doesn't move. The approach gets bolder. She asked people for fentanyl. She used the phrase, the Michael Jackson drug. Prosecutor Brad Bloodworth emphasized this at trial. She didn't know the street drug word. She just knew Michael Jackson died from taking some sort of drug. And she wanted that. She wanted something lethal. She said so, not in code, not in careful language, but in a reference to the most famous overdose death in modern history. She's not hiding her intent from herself. She knew exactly what she wanted and why. The internal justification had already been completed. The planning was just logistics. And then Valentine's Day 2022, she gave Eric a fentanyl-laced sandwich. He got desperately sick. He survived. And here's where the 17-day window becomes the most revealing piece of evidence in the entire case. Not forensically, but psychologically. Normal fear should have kicked in. Normal guilt, normal self-preservation. The average person, even someone who had reached the point of attempting something like this, would be flooded with panic. What if he figures it out? What if he tells a doctor? What if they run tests? That fear response is hardwired into most humans. It's the circuit breaker that prevents escalation. Corey spent the next 17 days not in a panic, but in revision. She acquired more fentanyl. She planned a second attempt. She adjusted the delivery method, a drink instead of food. She increased the dose to 5 times what would be lethal. The failure didn't produce guilt. It produced a better plan. The recalibration right there is the clearest window we may ever get into how this particular mind works. It separates someone in a crisis from someone operating on a fundamentally different internal system, a system where the emotional response to a failed attempt isn't horror at what you almost did, it's frustration that it didn't work, where the takeaway isn't, I can't believe I crossed that line, but I need to do this more effectively next time. That distinction is everything. It is the line between a person who snapped and a person who operates on different rules entirely, and the ability to sustain normal life during that window is almost more significant than the act itself. She was living with a man she just tried to kill, parenting their 3 children, running her business, texting her boyfriend, closing on real estate deals. And somewhere inside all of that, she was planning to try again with a higher dose, a different method, and apparently, no anxiety that stopped her. That level of compartmentalization isn't willpower, it's wiring. And in Corey's case, the wiring is broken in a very specific way. A mother who reads bedtime stories occupies one room. The businesswoman closing deals occupies another. The woman planning to end her husband's life occupies a third. And none of them talk to each other. The walls between those rooms are what make it possible to function, to smile, to parent, to plan a murder, and then make breakfast the next morning. March 3rd, 2022, Corey closed on a property. That evening, she made Eric a Moscow mule to celebrate and put 5 times a lethal dose of fentanyl in it. The celebration drink. The real estate closing. The final piece clicking into place. This wasn't an explosion of rage. It wasn't a crime of passion. It was a line item. A task being completed. A house closed today. The husband problem closes tonight. Eric drank that cocktail. He went to bed. By 3 in the morning, Corey called 911. EMTs noted that he appeared to have been dead for some time. He had 5 times a lethal dose of fentanyl in his system. The architecture of self-permission isn't built in a day. It's built over years of small internal negotiations. Each one slightly expands what's acceptable. Each one slightly reduces another person's humanity in your own mind. The affair that makes the husband feel like yesterday, the insurance policy that turns a person into a payout, the texts about a future where he doesn't exist. By the time Corey Richens poured that drink, the psychological work was already done. The moral calculus had been settled months earlier. The murder wasn't the beginning of anything. It was the conclusion of a process that started the moment Eric became worth more dead than alive. An equation only she was running. Not the violence, the calm. The ability to do it and then go to sleep in another room while three children slept down the hall and their father's body cooled. You can't do that and feel what most people feel. You can only do that if the person in the bed was never fully a person in your mind to begin with. Tomorrow she'd close out another deal alone. Then invite people over and a new room would need to be built. The one where she was a widow, not a killer. The one she'd live inside for 14 months. That room is next. And the most disturbing thing about it is how well it was furnished. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. It is coming up next in our conversation. And we can continue this conversation right now in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in. Links are in the description. We'll continue there. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The day after Eric Richens was found dead in his bed, Corey closed on a real estate deal alone. Then people came to the house. There was a gathering at the home where hours earlier, EMTs had noted her husband appeared to have been dead for some time. Break out the Tostitos and party dip! Most people would hear that and stop. Who does that? But if you're trying to understand the psychology of Corey Richens, not judge it, understand the machinery behind it. The gathering might be the most important behavioral data point in the entire case. Because a psychotherapist might look at that and see something more disturbing than callousness. They might see normalcy. Her normalcy. The possibility that for Corey, the day after Eric's death wasn't a performance of being okay. It was her actually being okay. Because in the room she'd already moved into, a terrible thing happened and life continues. The room where she put fentanyl in a drink is sealed. She's not in it anymore. And the room she's standing in now is the one where a businesswoman closes her deal and friends come by because something awful happened and she needs the company. That distinction between performing normalcy and inhabiting it is the key to understanding everything Corey did for the next 14 months. Let's start with the 911 call, shall we? And by the way, this is the second part in our Corey Richens Broken Brain series as we try to break down and not necessarily judge, but try to understand the modality behind the broken brain and decision processes of Corey Richens. That 911 call. 3 in the morning. She's hysterical, sobbing, barely able to answer the dispatcher's question. She told investigators she'd fallen asleep in one of her son's room. When she came back to the bedroom, she found Eric cold, like putting your arm over a cement brick. The grief was audible. The story was bullshit. The panic was convincing enough that the initial response treated this as a sudden death. But Eric's sister later testified that when she arrived at the scene, Corey appeared well put together, hair done, in the middle of the night. That juxtaposition matters, not because it proves she was acting, but because it reveals the speed at which someone with this psychology can shift between emotional states that serve different purposes. The hysterical call establishes the grieving wife on tape. The composed appearance when family arrives serves a different function. Control the room, manage the narrative, be the person in charge of what happens next. Most people can't switch between those modes that quickly. Someone whose emotional expression is organized around utility rather than genuine feeling can. Then the Google searches started.
How long does life insurance companies take to pay? If someone is poisoned, what does it go down on the death certificate as? What is considered a lethal dose of fentanyl? Can cops force you to do a lie detector test? My personal favorite, luxury prisons for the rich in America. Have you found that luxury prison yet, Corey, as you're watching us on your iPad sneering?
Hi. How's the commissary? They got beef jerky this week?
How to permanently delete information from an iPhone remotely. Can deleted text messages be retrieved? When does FBI get involved in a case? Read those not as evidence of guilt. Read them as a priority list, because that's what they are psychologically. These aren't the searches of a grieving widow, but they're also not the searches of a panicking criminal trying to cover tracks. They're the searches of a project manager assessing the status of a project. Where are the risks? What are the timelines? What's the contingency? How fast does the money arrive? What are the prisons like if this goes wrong? She's troubleshooting, not mourning. The emotional bandwidth that should be consumed by grief is instead dedicated to operational questions, and mixed in with the operational questions, a search for her own net worth. Corey Richens Comas net worth. She Googled herself to see what the world thought she was worth while her husband's cause of death was still pending. That search is the one that stops you, not because it's incriminating in the traditional sense, but because it tells you what her mind was focused on in the days after Eric's death. Not loss, not children, not what happened, her brand, her image. What does the outside world see when it looks at Corey Richens? That's the question consuming her while her husband's toxicology report is still being processed. Grief for most people is totalizing. It floods every channel. You can't think about insurance payments or payouts when you're devastated by loss, because the devastation consumes you. But for someone whose emotional architecture is organized into sealed compartments, grief and logistics can coexist. The widow who misses her husband and the woman who needs to know about death certificates and prison amenities can both be active simultaneously because they occupy different rooms. They never bump into each other in the hallway. And then she did the thing most people still can't wrap their heads around. She wrote a children's book. She had a ghost written. Are You With Me? Self-published in March of 23, 1 year after Eric's death, about 2 months before her arrest. The cover shows a father with angel wings watching over his son. Corey went on Good Things Utah, local ABC4 lifestyle show, to promote it. She sat on camera and talked about helping her boys process their father's unexpected death. Just because he's not present there with us physically, that doesn't mean his presence isn't there with us, she said. The prosecution framed the book as deflection, a calculated move to position herself as a grieving mother, not a suspect, and it was deflection. But it may have been something more complex. It may have been Corey building the version of reality she needed to inhabit. And this is what I keep coming back to when I try to make sense of the decision she made during this period. I'm not inside her head, but the pattern of behavior tells a story. And the story isn't just about covering tracks. It's about a brain that processes reality different than yours or mine. This is where a concept from clinical psychology becomes essential. Some personality structures don't experience deception the way most people understand it. The lie isn't a performance maintained through discipline and effort. It's migration. The person doesn't stand outside the lie and deliver it. They move into it. They unpack. They decorate. The original facts don't disappear entirely, but they get archived in a room that doesn't get visited. Eric's death becomes an unexpected tragedy, not because she's lying to the camera, but because in the room where she is a mother and an author, it was unexpected. The room where she put fentanyl in a drink exists, but She's not visiting it right now. She's in the room where a loving mother wrote a book to help her children heal. And in that room, the grief is real. The mission is real. The performance isn't a mask over the truth. It's an alternate truth she's built and moved into. If that's not creepy as shit, I don't know what is. That's what makes someone with this psychology so convincing. They're not suppressing tells. They're not fighting micro expressions. They believe what they're saying in the moment they're saying it, because the version of themselves doing the talking has been walled off from the version who did the thing. It's not acting. It's migration. And the people around her confirmed it. Friends testified at trial that Corey appeared financially successful, put together, a good mother dealing with a terrible loss. They didn't see through the performance because there was no performance in the traditional sense, no mask to slip. The woman they were spending time with in the compartment she was occupying genuinely was a grieving mother rebuilding her life, and that's why nobody saw it coming. You can't detect a lie when the person telling it doesn't experience it as one. Eric's own family saw something different. His sisters grew suspicious almost immediately. But the friends, the people Corey chose to surround herself with, the ones still standing by her to this day, known as flying monkeys, the audience she curated saw exactly what she wanted them to see, and they testified to it under oath as proof that the prosecution's version couldn't be right. She seemed fine. She seemed like a grieving mother moving forward. That testimony intended to help her is actually the most damning evidence of how complete the migration was. The constructed reality fooled the people who spent the most time inside it. In April of 23, Corey emailed Summit County preemptively, before anyone had publicly accused her of anything specific, to explain her exotic vacations since Eric's death, his alleged affair, her mental health, and their supposed lack of financial problems. Proactive reputation management. She felt suspicion building, which means part of her understood why it existed, but she also believed, while typing that email, that the right explanation would make it all go away. Awareness and confidence running on parallel tracks that never intersect. That email is the psychology in miniature. She addresses the vacation. She means she knows they look bad. She addresses Eric's alleged affair, which means she's already constructed a counter narrative where he's the flawed one. She addresses the finances, which means she knows people are asking questions. Every item she preemptively explains is an item she knows looks suspicious, and yet the act of explaining them feels to her like resolution. Like once people hear the context, the questions will just stop. That confidence in her own explanatory power, the belief that the right story told well enough resolves anything, is the same mechanism that will later produce a children's book, a walk the dog letter, a fiction novel defense, and a 45-minute sentencing speech. The scale changes, the mechanism doesn't. The TV tour is where this psychology reaches its most disturbing expression. Going on television to promote a children's grief book while you are the reason those children are grieving requires a specific capacity most people don't possess. It requires the ability to inhabit a constructed identity so completely that the performance generates no anxiety, no tell, no moment where the real self bleeds through, because there is no real self to bleed through. There's just the room she's in right now. And right now, she's a grieving mother helping her children. That's the truth of this moment. The other truth is in a room she's not visiting. And she didn't do one interview and retreat. She leaned in, went on local radio, went on the lifestyle show. She promoted the book on social media. She engaged with the public as a grieving mother for months. Each appearance was another coat of paint on the new room. Each interaction, another piece of furniture. The more she performed the role, the more real it became. Not as a strategy, but as a psychological migration. Every sympathetic comment, every message from a parent who related to the book, every moment of public validation reinforced the constructed identity and made the sealed room a little harder to remember. The question most people ask is, did she believe her own story? And the answer nobody finds satisfying? Yes and no, simultaneously, depending on which room she was standing in when you asked. If you caught her at 3 a.m. alone with the Google searches, she knew. If you caught her on a TV set holding up a book with angel wings on the cover, she was a grieving mother. Both were real. Neither was the whole truth. And the architecture that kept them separate was the same architecture that allowed her to pour a drink, go to another room, and wait. The performance held for 14 months, from March 22 to May 23. And then on May 8th, the arrest came. There's something about this kind of psychology that nobody talks about enough. It's not unsettling because of what it hides. It's unsettling because of what it reveals about sincerity. Corey may have meant every word on that TV segment, every sentence of that email to the country, every page of that book. She may have held her children and felt genuine tenderness while knowing in a sealed-off corner of her mind exactly what she had done to their father. The tenderness and the truth coexisting, never touching, both completely real. That's what should unsettle you more than anything else in this case. Not a woman who faked grief to cover a murder. That story makes sense. A woman who migrated into genuine grief, who built a room where the loss was real and lived inside it while the room next door held the reason it happened. That story makes you wonder how many rooms you'd never see if you were standing in someone else's house. The arrest ended the TV tour. It didn't end the migration. From a jail cell with recorded phone lines and monitored mail, the narrative machine kept running. It just had to work harder. And the desperation of what it produced next tells you more about the compulsion driving it than anything she did while she was free. That's coming up. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. We're diving into it in our next chapter. We'll continue our conversation in the comment section and Substack and YouTube. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.